Well, it is time for us to wish our listeners who are celebrating a birthday today a very happy birthday. We have one listener we're aware of, Lorraine Wilson from Cedar Rapids. Happy birthday to you, Lorraine. All of us here at Iris would like to wish you a very happy birthday. And this is a reminder that you're listening to Iris, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you are hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you're not a registered Iris user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now here's Barb with today's obituaries.
Thank you, Dennis. Julianne Lutz Thorson passed away on March 1st at the age of 66 after a courageous five-year-long battle with a brain tumor and other complex health issues. Ju was born in Mason City on July 20, 1957, the first of five children, to Robert, William, and E. Joanne Lutz. Ju moved from Iowa to Illinois and then to New Mexico as a child, before moving back to Iowa in 1969. Ju graduated from Roosevelt High School in 1975, where she ignited her passion for journalism while being involved with both the school newspaper and yearbook. She attended Drake University and received a Bachelor of Arts in Journalism in 1979. She thoroughly enjoyed her internship at United Press International, writing press releases and reporting on weather alerts and sports scores well into the night on the graveyard shift. She was the editor of the 1979 Iowa Official Register. While at Drake, Jewel was a proud member of the Gamma Phi Beta sorority and served as president her senior year. She met her husband, Robert Thorson, at Drake University in 1977, and they married August 18, 1979, in Des Moines. As Jewel launched her career, she continued her education and earned her Master of Public Administration at Drake, graduating in 1984. While her four kids were young, Jewel worked for the Iowa Supreme Court, followed by a position as a member of the Iowa Senate Republican staff. While she may not have always aligned with the views of the party, Jewel enjoyed the fast pace and influence of change in the democratic process. After completing her master's degree, Jewel transitioned into the private sector as the director of human resources at First Group Realty. After her youngest child was born, Jewel took on the important job of being a stay-at-home mom to the four young kids. As Jewel's kids entered school, Jewel slowly re-entered the workforce. Jewel began work at Simpson College in 1992 as adjunct professor and quickly found herself completing 26 years of work that became a true passion. Jewel taught journalism, organizational behavior, human resources, and management. Jewel's time at Simpson ended in 2018 when her health prevented her from continuing. If health hadn't been a barrier, Jewel most certainly would still be teaching today. Jewel is survived by her four children, five grandchildren. Funeral and interment will be held at Faith Lutheran Church in Clive, Iowa, upon completion of construction of the columbarium sometime during the summer of 2024, with the date to be announced. Patricia Louise Pillmeyer died peacefully in her sleep in the early morning of February 28th. She was 99 years old. Passionate about the family farm, she always maintained that the only way she would leave the farm was in a box, and that is exactly what she did. She lived a full life and loved her family above all else. She is survived by three of her four children and several grandchildren, but she also had many friends she cared about deeply. She will be missed by many in her church, where she was active to the end. In lieu of flowers, please support St. John and Paul Church in Altoona, Iowa. Patricia's ashes will be laid to rest with her husband at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery in Van Meter. A massive Christian burial will be held on Saturday, March 9th, at St. John and Paul at 11 a.m., followed by a luncheon. James W. Lee, 89, of Runnels, passed away on March 4th at home. Jim is survived by his wife, Ruth, four children, 11 grandchildren, and 11 great-grandchildren. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. on Friday, March 8th, at New Life Church, 6036 Northeast 12th Avenue in Pleasant Hill. The funeral will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, March 9th, also at New Life Church. Lunch will be served afterwards. For more information, please visit petersonfuneralservice.com. Benjamin J. Haller III, 78, died March 2, 2024. The funeral will be Saturday, March 9th, at St. Pius X Church in Urbandale. Visitation will be at 10 a.m., with Mass at 11 a.m. The full obituary is available online at McLaren'sResthavenChapel.com. Nita Mae Hill Brower passed away on March 2nd. Nita, the daughter of John and Juanita Hill, was born April 23, 1935. Nita was a lifelong resident of Des Moines. She graduated from East High School in 1953 and married Kenneth Brower on June 18, 1954. Nita worked as a private secretary until she became a mother. Then she became a stay-at-home mom for her three children. During that time, Nita taught Sunday school, served as a homeroom parent for her children's school, was a leader for her Campfire Girls group, and sold Avon. Nita graduated from Iowa State University in 1983. She taught English at East High School. Nita was an active member of her church for over 75 years, serving in multiple ways. She enjoyed spending time with her family and friends, also enjoyed her pets, baking Christmas goodies, reading, camping, fishing, and watching the wildlife in her backyard. She is survived by three children, as well as several grandchildren and great-grandchildren. A memorial service will be held on Saturday, March 9th at 11 a.m. at Union Park United Methodist Church at 2305 East 12th Street in Des Moines. Memorials may be given to her church. William L., known as Bill Anderson, 76, passed away on March 3rd at Iowa Methodist Medical Center in Des Moines. Bill was born on March 5th, 1947, to Lyle and LaDonna Anderson in Des Moines. He graduated from Montezuma High School in 1965 and attended Drake University. Anxious to begin his business career, Bill purchased and operated Roosevelt Brewery for over 20 years. During the 1980s, a home building business, A&H Construction, accompanied the retail operation. The companies then transitioned into the commercial real estate development firm Anderson Properties Incorporated. Bill is survived by his son and daughter and six grandchildren, his former wife of 43, Mary Anderson, and a brother, Danny. Visitation will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, March 7th at Life Church, Des Moines, 15915 Hickman Road in Clive. Funeral service will follow at 11 a.m. Friday, March 8th, also at the church. Private family burial will be at a later date. Memorials may be directed to the family to be distributed to the First Tee, the Urbandale and Grimes Fire and Police Departments, and various other charities in Bill's honor. Condolences of sympathy may be expressed to the family at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Richard Perry, 90, of Marshalltown, passed away Thursday, February 29th, at the Marshalltown Veterans Home. Memorial services will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, March 8th, at the chapel at the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown. A luncheon will follow the service at Anderson Funeral Home in Marshalltown. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Alzheimer's Association at www.act.alz.org or the Animal Rescue League. Anderson Funeral Homes in Marshalltown has been entrusted with the arrangements. Online condolences may be sent to andersonfhs.com. Richard Lyle Perry was born on November 20, 1933, to Lyle and Irma Christensen Perry in Clemens, Iowa. Known as Dick growing up, he attended Clemens High School and enlisted in the United States Army following graduation. He very proudly served his country during the Korean War from 1953 to 1955, discharged at the rank of corporal. He enjoyed his service guarding and moving the atomic Annie cannon throughout Germany. Dick was united in marriage to Beverly Joan Ullery on June 16, 1956, at Minerva Wesley in Albion, Iowa, and would later be blessed with two daughters. Dick worked as an air traffic control controller for the Federal Aviation Administration for several airports across the Midwest. His job took the family to Marshalltown to cities in Minnesota, Kansas, and Missouri, then back to Iowa, where they made their long-time home in West Des Moines in 1969. Dick and Joan returned to Marshalltown to retire in 1991. Dick is survived by two daughters, three grandchildren, and two great-granddaughters. He was also blessed with many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his wife, Joan, and his siblings. There are no words to truly express the family's gratitude for the respect, kindness, friendship, and joy the staff and resident family of the Marshalltown Veterans Home had shown Dick and his family all these years. They have been blessed by your grace. It is without a doubt that Dick would have wanted to close to say by saying thank you one last time. Eddie Ray Fuller, 55, passed away on March 3rd. He was born on August 23rd, 1968, to John and Rhea Fuller. Eddie graduated from Southeast Polk High School in 1986 and worked at Wells Fargo. He loved hunting, a good podcast, long drives with his dog Dahlia, and his favorite thing to do was spend time with his friends and family. Eddie is survived by his sister, brother, many nieces, nephews, great-nieces, and a great-nephew. Family were great friends on Friday, March 8th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Hamilton's Altoona Funeral Home at 105 4th Street Southwest in Altoona. Services for Eddie will take place on Saturday, March 9th at 10 a.m. at the funeral home. Burial will then be at Laurel Hill Cemetery in Des Moines. Memorial contributions may be directed to the family in loving memory of Eddie. Online condolences may be expressed at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Paul Homer Miller, 74, passed away Saturday, March 2nd, after a short battle with esophageal cancer. Cremation has taken place, and memorial services will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, March 9th, at the Twig Funeral Home in Panora. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service. Memorials may be left to the discretion of the family. The full obituary can be viewed on Twig, that's TWIGG, funeralhome.com.
That concludes today's obituaries, though this next article is sort of an obituary of its own. Drake University's retired live mascot, Griff Number 1, dies at age 11. Drake University is mourning the loss of Griff 1, the university's first ever official live mascot who joined the Drake family in 2015. In a social media post on X, formerly known as Twitter, Drake University announced Griff 1 had died on Monday, March 4th. Griff died surrounded by his family. Aaron Bell, the Associate Director of Marketing and Manager of the Live Mascot Program, Bell's husband, Kevin, and their two children. "I have loved every minute of caring for Griff 1," Bell said in a news release from the university. "He was an integral part of my family and the heart of the Drake community for 8 years. He was the perfect bulldog to launch Drake University's official live mascot program, continuing the legacy of Porterhouse and building a strong foundation for the program to build upon with Griff II. He radiated a sense of joy, strength, loyalty, and kindness that uniquely united and inspired the Bulldog community. Griff I was born in 2012 and was inducted as Drake's first ever official live mascot in 2015. He officially retired in 2020. Griff I passed the baton to his younger brother, Griff II, after he retired. If you had the privilege of meeting Griff I, you know the immeasurable impact he had on our campus," Drake University President Marty Martin said in a release. "He was an enduring symbol of pride, loyalty, and kindness, and he embodied the Drake spirit. His legacy will be cherished forever." The Bells also were the owners of Porterhouse, who preceded Griff I as Drake's mascot. Porterhouse was named the winner of Drake's Most Beautiful Bulldog contest in 2009 and served as the university's live mascot until his death in 2013. You can read more about the history of Drake's live mascot program on their website. "I will miss him terribly, as will so many others," Bell said in the release. "It is not lost on me how fortunate I was to be the one holding his leash and taking him home at night. He was the best boy, and I couldn't have possibly loved him more. Griff 1 leaves behind the Griff Gives Back annual food collection campaign, which has donated more than 100,000 pounds of dog food to the Pet Project Midwest. Griff 1 also is a certified therapy dog. There will be a plaque added to the Bulldog Plaza, which was built in 2020 outside of Old Main and includes a bronze statue of Griff 1 to pay tribute to Griff 1 and the live mascot program. Members of the Drake community and the fans are encouraged to leave a message and share photos with the Bell family or Griff 2 on Facebook or Instagram using hashtag RememberingGriff1, that being a number one.
Nonprofit to help families navigate disability services. The Iowa Department of Education has hired a Johnston-based nonprofit to help families of students with disabilities access services and understand their rights, after ending a contract with the state's area education agencies for a similar service. The department announced Monday it was awarding a contract to the ASK Resource Center, a nonprofit that provides information, training, and advocacy for families of students with disabilities. The organization will replace the Family and Educator Partnership Program, which is run by Iowa's AEAs and is ending July 1st after the state decided not to renew the program's contract. Governor Kim Reynolds is pursuing legislation this year that would overhaul how the AEAs offer special education services to students and other supports to school districts. But Heather Doe, a spokesperson for the Department of Education, said the department's decision not to renew the Family and Education Partnership Program was independent from any proposed legislation. There have been concerns regarding conflicts of interest, inconsistencies in support provided, and confusion of roles and responsibilities with documentation beginning in 2014, Doe said in an email Thursday. Despite the department's efforts to address these concerns, unacceptable variances in support provided to families of students with disabilities persist. Cindy Yellick, chief administrator of the Heartland AEA in Central Iowa, said last week that her team was hearing a pretty significant outcry from parents over the fact that the Family and Educator Partnership Program was ending. The Department of Education announced the new contract with the ASK Resource Center in a news release Monday. Quote, the Department of Education remains committed to ensuring all families of children with disabilities consistently receive timely, high-quality resources and supports that are responsive to their needs, McKinney Snow, the department's director, said in a statement included in the release. In partnership with ASK Resource Center, families across Iowa will have the support of family specialists, family mentors, and experts focused on accessibility and post-secondary transitions as they advocate for their children with disabilities, end quote. The ASK Resource Center will provide 18 full-time positions for the program, including a family support supervisor, lead family support specialist, 9 full-time family support specialists, and other professionals who provide one-on-one support to families of students with disabilities, the news release says. Staff will be based in each of Iowa's 9 AEA regions, according to the release. The responsibilities will include helping families understand education and disability laws, including the Individuals with Disabilities Act, as well as preparing families for meetings with a team in charge of implementing their students' Individualized Education Program, or IEP, attending IEP meetings, and helping families resolve disputes with school districts. Doe said the organization will serve families of children with disabilities from birth through age 21. Karen Thompson, the executive director of ASK, said the organization has been providing services to families since 1997. We were excited to partner with the Iowa Department of Education team to scale these services and create a streamlined experience to ensure effective family and school partnerships, she said in the release. The contract runs from March 1, 2024 through February 28, 2025, and has the option of 5-year-long extensions. The first year of the contract will be funded with $1 million through the Individuals with Disabilities Act. Doe said Iowa's Department of Administrative Services approved the Department of Education's request to award the contract to ASK after it determined there were no viable entities who could bid for the contract. Code ASK is the only parent training and information center for Iowa recognized by the Federal Office of Special Education Programs to serve parents of children of all ages and all types of disabilities, she said in an email. The Department of Education will use a number of metrics to assess how the organization is fulfilling the terms of the contract, including looking at how many families the organization assists, surveying parents and families on their satisfaction with the help they receive, and examining the quality and consistency of the services provided, according to the news release. The state's grant to the AEAs for the Family and Educator Partnership Program was worth $1.3 million and also paid for 18 employees statewide, including 16 full-time workers and 2 part-time workers.
Dad of Michigan school shooter goes on trial. James Crumbly bought a gun for his son. Wife says he managed its storage from Detroit. On Tuesday morning, James Crumbly became the third and final member of his family to come before the justice system over a mass school shooting that left 4 children dead and 7 other people injured. The shooter, Ethan Crumbly, pleaded guilty to murder and other charges and was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. His mother, Jennifer Crumbly, was convicted last month of involuntary manslaughter. She made history as the first parent in America held criminally responsible for a mass shooting carried out by their child. Jury selection began Tuesday. James Crumbly faces the same charges as his wife, and, like his wife, he is accused of being a bad parent whose choices turned out deadly. But unlike his wife, he made one key decision that prosecutors are likely to focus on. He took his son on a Black Friday shopping trip in 2021 and bought a gun the teen had long begged for. 4 days later, Ethan Crumbly used it to shoot up his high school. "I think it's a real problem for him," veteran criminal defense attorney Bill Swore said of the gun purchased. According to his wife's testimony in her trial, James Crumbly also was responsible for storing the gun. The Detroit Free Press has followed this case for more than 2 years, during which prosecutors have disclosed scores of allegations against the parents based on journal entries, on text messages, social media posts, instant messenger conversations, and interviews with police and psychiatrists who spoke to the shooter after the massacre. Prosecutors allege both parents ignored a child in crisis. Instead of getting him help, they bought him a gun. The parents have maintained that they never saw any signs that their son would harm anyone or shoot up his school, and that the gun really wasn't really a gift. It was hidden and to be used only at the shooting range with his father, Jennifer Crumbly testified. Former federal prosecutor Mark Chutkow, who has closely followed the case, said the prosecution will point out that the dad bought the gun for his son, then certified on the firearm forms that he was buying the gun for himself. It will emphasize that the dad was the one responsible for safely storing and securing the gun at home, but failed to do so. Finally, he said, the prosecution will argue that the dad was privy to the most important red flags of his son's deteriorating mental health and the growing fascination with guns, and was present with the mom at the pivotal meeting where school officials revealed the son's disturbing, desperate drawing of gun violence. The parents left their son in school, and he committed the shooting later that day. To be sure, the prosecution still has a challenging case to prove, Chutkow said, and that the dad was grossly negligent in handling the gun and reasonably foresaw that his son might use the gun to harm others. But the prosecution now has a successful playbook based on the mom's conviction, he said, and will similarly emphasize in this case the various times the parents failed to take steps to protect their son and to warn others. According to courtroom testimony and videos, James Crumbly came across as more emotional toward his son and potentially more supportive than his wife. He is seen and heard crying often and offering comfort to his son, which legal experts have said could help him at trial. The defense will try to paint a more sympathetic portrait of the dad as a struggling DoorDash driver who was devastated about what his son did, to contrast him from the mom, who may have come across as more self-absorbed and aloof, Chutkow said. Chutkow also anticipates that the defense will emphasize that the dad wasn't as aware of his son's alleged downward spiral because the son was texting mostly with his mom about his mental distress. James Crumbly has long maintained that he never saw anything that would lead him to believe his son was homicidal and that the gun was secured in his bedroom armoire, unloaded, with the bullets hidden in a separate drawer. There's a journal entry that could help the father, though it's unclear when the shooter wrote it. Quote, I will have to find where my dad hid my 9mm before I can shoot up the school, end quote. Defense experts argue this is a key issue in James Crumley's case, and that he did not give his son easy access, as the prosecution has alleged. Veteran criminal defense attorney Art Wise doubts the prosecution will dramatically alter its approach in the James Crumley trial, though he believes this case will focus heavily on how the weapon was stored. Obviously, Dad didn't do a good job of hiding it from his son, Wise said. The jury will likely hear a lot about what steps the dad did or didn't take to keep the gun away from his son, he stressed. And Weiss has argued, if it really was the boy's gun, then why did the parents have to hide it? The prosecution is trying to prove that the dad knew his son was mentally struggling, but was focused on his own life. Prosecution is expected to highlight text messages the shooter sent his friend, such as, quote, I actually asked my dad to take me to the doctor yesterday, but he just gave me some pills and told me to suck it up, end quote. The defense has argued that neither parent ever saw those messages, and the parents deny their son ever made such pleas to them. The following journal entries could also prove problematic for James Crumley, the jury foreperson in his wife's trial told the media that the journal played a huge part during the deliberations. Among the excerpts to be cited at the trial, my parents won't listen to me about help or a therapist. All I need is my 9mm pistol, which I'm currently begging my dad for. James Crumley's lawyer has not yet disclosed whether he will take the stand. Legal experts have opinion that Jennifer Crumley, who did testify, may have hurt her case by coming across as cold and telling the jury that she would not have done anything differently.
And brief items from the 50 states. In Indianapolis, Indiana, Indiana's bat populations are under pressure, and the Hoosier National Forest is reminding would-be spelunkers to stay out of caves until May. White nose syndrome can be transferred from cave to cave by hitching a ride on people's shoes and clothes. Keeping the caves closed reduces this threat and lets the bats hibernate in peace. In Afton, Minnesota, investigators are trying to determine what caused a small plane to crash near a home, killing both people on board. In Wood River, Nebraska, officials said one person was found dead after a house exploded, the Omaha World Herald reported. In Topeka, Kansas, last month was Topeka's second warmest February on record, the National Weather Service says. February brought the capital city an average temperature of 45.1 degrees, 10.2 degrees above Topeka's historical average for February of 34.9, according to a monthly weather summary.
Thank you, Barb. And that's it for this first 90 minutes. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Your readers have been Barb DeHeck and Dennis May. And now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Your new readers are Patty Daniels, that's me, and Pam Rhodes. And we're going to continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. And here's Pamela with our first article.
Liberals fume over court's ruling on Trump. Super Tuesday is over when 15 states and one territory cast their vote in presidential primaries. Thanks to a definitive ruling Monday, former President Donald Trump remained on the ballot in all of the states. Colorado and other states had tried to keep Trump off the primary ballot because of his actions leading up to and during the U.S. Capitol riot on January 6, 2021. By claiming Trump had committed some form of insurrection that day, those in favor of booting him said this was an effort to preserve democracy, something Democrats are keen on saying these days. But could there be anything less democratic than preventing the American people from having their choice of presidential candidate? The high court put an end to that possibility, thank goodness. All nine justices, including the three liberal ones, concurred that only Congress has the authority to restrict a candidate's access to the ballot if an alleged violation of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment takes place. That's the constitutional amendment that prevents those who have engaged in an insurrection from holding a federal office. We conclude that states may disqualify persons holding or attempting to hold state office, the justices explained, but states have no power under the Constitution to enforce Section 3 with respect to federal offices, especially the presidency. Think what you want about Trump, but he deserves his day in court related to his actions on January 6, 2021. At this point, he hasn't been convicted of anything, and just because Democrats and many other Americans don't like what they saw that day, that's far from a high bar, enough bar to keep him off the ballot. This is a guy whom nearly half of voters sought to reelect in 2020, and Republican primary voters seem set on choosing again. He's hardly a fringe candidate. I had hoped that a unanimous decision would appease hand-wringing over the ruling by indicating it was firmly rooted in the law of the Constitution, not ideology. That's also what Justice Amy Coney Barrett wanted, too. In a concurring opinion, she wrote, "Particularly in this circumstance, writings on the court should turn the national temperature down, not up. For present purposes, our differences are far less important than our unanimity. All nine justices agree on the outcome of the case. This is the message Americans should take home." No such luck. The unhinged responses started flowing immediately. Leftist provocateur Keith Olbermann, for instance, unleashed a hot take insulting the three liberal women justices for having proved themselves inept at reading comprehension. I'm sure Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor would beg to differ. Olbermann also made the rational observation that the court, one of the three integral branches of government, should be dissolved. You get the idea. Then there were news posts, such as this one from the Associated Press. Supreme Court restores Trump to ballot, rejecting state attempts to hold him accountable for the attack on the Capitol in 2021. That's not what the court ruled on at all. But why let the facts get in the way of anti-Trump framing? So much of the left, including the news media, are so blinded by their hatred of Trump that they forget how our system of government is supposed to work. The surest way to hold Trump accountable will happen at the ballot box, now, during the primaries, and in November. If Democrats really feared him so much, they could run pretty much anyone other than President Joe Biden, who is in serious danger of losing in the general election. Trying to pull unwise maneuvers like Colorado did will only further divide the country and contribute to the distrust in elections that has been building in the past few years. Let the people vote, which is the clearest way for citizens to have a say in our republic. And this article is written by Ingrid Jacques, who is a columnist at USA Today. You can contact her at ijacques@usatoday.com or on X, formerly Twitter, @Ingrid_Jacques.
Thanks, Pam. A change in FDA's laws could spur innovation and save lives. Written for us by Kendra Riley. She's an opinion contributor. 4 years ago, my daughter Olivia was diagnosed with a rare and aggressive genetic disorder that attacks the brain and nervous system. She was rapidly losing the ability to walk and talk, and doctors told us that the disease was progressive, meaning Olivia's condition would continue to worsen and she would eventually need hospice care. She was not yet 2 years old. A few months later, our youngest daughter, Kiera, was diagnosed with the same genetic disorder, metachromatic leukodystrophy. It's called MLD. But unlike her older sister, Kiera had not yet begun to show symptoms. That bit of luck gave us the extraordinary opportunity to try to save her life. As a cutting-edge gene therapy treatment was showing promising results in non-symptomatic MLD patients. Devastatingly, it was too late for the treatment to help Olivia. But we were told it could potentially save Kira's life if she was treated before the onset of symptoms. There was one caveat. The 5-month-long personalized treatment, which would be tailored to Kiera based on her DNA, was not available in the United States due to the outdated U.S. drug approval process. To get Kiera the treatment she needed, our family would have to relocate halfway across the globe to Milan, Italy, in the middle of a global pandemic. It was a race against the clock to get there before Kiera's symptoms set in. Thankfully, our community rallied around us to help raise the $500,000 we needed to make the move and pay for the therapy, and we were able to get Kiera the treatment in time. But not every family would have been able to do the same. As genetic and personalized medicine advances at a rapid rate, I fear more and more parents and families will face similar situations. That's why I have been advocating for new laws that would allow patients to try potentially life-saving individualized treatments that are out of reach now in the United States. Those laws are needed because the Food and Drug Administration, charged with ensuring the safety and efficacy of treatments and medications, often keeps patients from accessing innovative treatments. The FDA's current clinical trial system, which puts new medicines through a series of studies that take an average of 10 years to complete, is designed to determine the effects of a treatment on a large population of patients. But individualized treatments, the latest advancement in modern medicine, cannot go through this type of large-scale testing because they are customized to patients based on their individual genetics. For example, Kiera's treatment was created by examining her unique DNA and determining how to modify it to ensure her body kept functioning properly. It would be impossible for the FDA to conduct a large-scale clinical trial on this type of treatment because the treatment is different for each individual and because the patient pool for such a rare disease is so small. As a result, countless patients with rare and genetic diseases are being denied access to potentially life-saving treatments that are caught up in the FDA's outdated clinical trial system. Patients like my daughter do not have time to waste. Luckily, there is a solution that policymakers can implement to give patients hope now, the right to try for individual treatments. This law would allow patients suffering from rare and genetic diseases to try personalized treatments not yet approved by the FDA, as long as they have the support of their physician and have exhausted other treatment options. This policy would have an outsized impact on patients with the rare diseases. Although rare diseases have small patient pools, about 30 million Americans are estimated to have a rare disease. What's more, 80% of these rare diseases are genetic in nature, and 95% have no FDA-approved treatment. I've been working with the Goldwater Institute to help raise awareness of stories like mine and pass right to try for individual treatment laws. The law has already passed in Nevada and my home state of Arizona with overwhelming bipartisan support, and lawmakers in California, Iowa, and Maryland have introduced legislation for consideration this legislative session, with several other states set to follow. But no patient in any state should be denied potentially life-saving treatments. I urge lawmakers across the country to remember those suffering from a rare disease and support right to try for individualized treatments. Kiara's gene therapy treatment was a success, and she is now a vibrant four-year-old who loves to practice gymnastics, go swimming in the pool, and ride her bike, all things she would never have been able to do without receiving this treatment in Italy. I often refer to Olivia as Kiara's guardian angel on earth because her diagnosis allowed us to get Kiara into treatment before it was too late. I can only hope that our story continues to help other families fighting rare diseases. Now, Kendra Riley's a business owner and mother of three girls, two of whom were diagnosed with MLD in 2020. Riley has since become an advocate for other families fighting rare diseases.
We're turning now to the sports on TV for Wednesday, March 6th. All of these times are in the Eastern time zone. Canadian Hockey League, 7 p.m., NHLN, Sault Ste. Marie at Sudbury. College Basketball Men's, 6:30 p.m., FS1, Villanova at Seton Hall. 7 p.m., BTN, Northwestern at Michigan State. ESPN2, Tennessee at South Carolina. ESPNU, Boston College at Miami of Florida. And SECN, LSU at Arkansas, 7:30 p.m., CBSSN, Xavier at Butler, 8:30 p.m., FS1, University of Connecticut at Marquette, 9 p.m., BTN, Indiana at Minnesota, ESPN2, BYU at Iowa State, ESPNU, Mississippi State at Texas A&M, SECN, Vanderbilt at Kentucky, 9:30 p.m., CBSSN, Utah State at San Jose State, 10:30 p.m., FS1, Fresno State at New Mexico, 12 a.m. Thursday, Spectrum, Cal State Northridge at Hawaii, College Basketball Women's, 11 a.m., SECN, Southeastern Tournament, Georgia versus Kentucky, first round at Greenville, South Carolina. 1 p.m., ACCN, Atlantic Coast Tournament, Boston College versus Clemson, first round at Greensboro, North Carolina. 1:30 p.m., SECN, Southeastern Tournament, Missouri versus Florida, first round at Greensville, South Carolina. 3 p.m., Pac-12 Tournament, Oregon versus Colorado, first round at Las Vegas. 3:30 p.m., ACCN, Atlantic Coast Tournament, Pittsburgh versus Georgia Tech, first round at Greensboro, North Carolina. 5 p.m., ESPNU, Ball State at Kent State. 5:30 p.m., Pac-12 Tournament, Washington State versus California, first round at Las Vegas. 6:30 p.m., ACCN, Atlantic Coast Tournament, Wake Forest versus Virginia, first round, Greensboro, North Carolina. Peacock, Big Ten Tournament, Northwestern versus Purdue, first round at Minneapolis. 9 p.m., Pac-12 Tournament, Washington versus Arizona, first round, Las Vegas. Peacock, Big Ten Tournament, Rutgers versus Minnesota, first round at Minneapolis. 11:30 p.m., Pac-12 Pac-12N, Pac-12 Tournament, Arizona State versus Utah, first round at Las Vegas. College Golf Women's, 2:30 p.m., Golf, Darius Rucker Intercollegiate, first round, Long Cove Club, Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. Golf, 11 p.m., Golf, LPGA Tour, the Blue Bay LPGA, first round, Gian Lake Blue Bay Golf Club in Hainan, China. MLB Baseball, 1 p.m., MLBN, Spring Training, New York Mets versus Houston, West Palm Beach, Florida. NBA Basketball, 7:40 p.m., ESPN, LA Clippers at Houston. 10:05 p.m., ESPN, Milwaukee at Golden State. NHL Hockey, 7 p.m., TNT and Max, Buffalo at Toronto. 9:30 p.m., TNT and Max, Detroit at Colorado. Soccer, men's. 12:40 p.m., CBSSN, UEFA Europa League, Atlanta at Sporting Club de Portugal, round of 16, leg 1. 3 p.m., CBS, UEFA Champions League, Copenhagen at Manchester City, round of 16, leg 2. 5:55 p.m., FS2, CONCACAF, CONCAF, I believe, Champions Cup, Al Julens at New England Revolution, round of 16, leg 1. 10:55 p.m., CONCACAF Champions Cup, Columbus Crew at Houston Dynamo FC, round of 16, leg 1. 9:55 p.m., FS2, CONCACAF Champions Club, Club America at CD Guadalajara, round of 16, leg 1. Tennis, 2 p.m., tennis, BNP Paribas Open, ATP/WTA, first round. And 10 p.m., tennis, BNP Paribas Open, ATP/WTA, first round.
Our first article is College Women's Basketball. Clark named Big Ten Player of the Year for the third time, written for us by Dargan Southard of the Register. To save time and energy, the Big Ten Conference probably could have given Caitlin Clark its Player of the Year award in October. Waiting until March emphatically produced the same conclusion. The Iowa women's basketball star has been named Big Ten Player of the Year for a third consecutive season, becoming the first to do so unanimously since Ohio State's Jessica Davenport from 2005 to 2007. Additionally, Clark joins Ohio State's Jantel Lavender and Kelsey Mitchell as the only players to win or split at least three Big Ten POYs. That's Player of the Year. Clark, though, has taken conference dominance to a new level. Her most recent Big Ten Player of the Week award marked the 11th time this season and 29th time overall that Clark has earned weekly honors. She's also been named either WBCA Player of the Week or AP National Player of the Week a combined 11 times this year. Tuesday's announcement is the first of many Player of the Year awards likely coming Clark's way in the weeks ahead. After sweeping every major POY honor last season, Clark is a heavy favorite to do the same this season. Among the many jaw-dropping stats Clark has produced this season, these pop the most. Clark leads the country in 20-point games with 30, while also being the only player this year with 900-plus points, 250-plus assists, and 175-plus rebounds. She's now scored 20-plus points in 115 of her 130 career games, while becoming the first Division I player, men or women, to record 3,600-plus points, 1,000-plus assists, and 850-plus rebounds in a career. Clark has also drained at least one three-pointer in an NCAA best 87 straight games. The number 2 seed Hawkeyes are back in action Friday at the Big Ten Tournament in Minneapolis, where Iowa will face the Penn State Wisconsin winner at 5:30 p.m. inside the Target Center. Clark, who was also named a first-team All-Big Ten selection, wasn't the only Iowa player to pick up recognition. Sophomore Hannah Strucki and senior Kate Martin were both named second-team All-Conference selections by the coaches and media. And Dargan Southard, in case you didn't already know, is a sports trending reporter and covers Iowa athletics for the Des Moines Register and HawkCentral.com. You could email him at Southard, msouthard, at Gannett, or follow him on Twitter at Dargan Southard.
ISU freshman Crooks named first-team All-Big 12 pick. Early in the Iowa State women's basketball season, it quickly became obvious that Iowa State's Audie Crooks was one of the top young players in the entire conference, earning 4 Big 12 Freshman of the Week honors. But Crooks isn't just one of the best freshmen in the league, she's one of the best players in the Big 12. Crooks, a center for the Cyclones, was named to the All-Big 12 coach's first team, the league announced Tuesday. The Algona native was one of 4 unanimous selections, and it's certainly easy to see why after the season she's compiled. The 6'3" player ranked 3rd in the league in field goal percentage, .582, 5th in scoring, 18.3, and 7th in rebounds, 7.7 per game. Crooks was a big reason for the Iowa State success this season, with the Cyclones compiling an 18-10 mark, including 12-6 in Big Ten play. Iowa State, which has received Iowa State, which received a double bye in this week's Big 12 tournament, is also likely headed to the NC2A tournament. There were huge exceptions when Crooks arrived at Iowa State. She was a superstar at Bishop Garrigan High School in Algona, where she was ranked number 57 on the 2023 Hoop Girls Recruiting ESPN W100. Crooks guided her team to 2 state championships in basketball and poured in an all-class state tournament record 49 points in her final game. Still, there were questions surrounding Crooks and whether she would be able to adapt from playing small school basketball to high-level competition at Iowa State in the Big 12. The jump wasn't difficult for her. Crooks was eased into things early on and came off the bench in Iowa State's first 4 games. After a successful start, Crooks earned a starting spot and never gave up. She became the focal point of Iowa State's offense and gave the Cyclones a dominant post presence they haven't had for years. Crooks' 512 points are an Iowa State single-season freshman record. Crooks wasn't the only Cyclone recognized by the Big 12. Freshman Addie Brown was named an honorable mention pick. Brown earned a starting spot right away and quickly became an important part of Iowa State's young roster. During her first season, she averaged 13.3 points, 8.4 rebounds, and 4.9 assists per game. Crooks and Brown were also named to the league's all-freshman team. Oklahoma coach Jenny Barazak, who played at Dowling High School and the University of Iowa before coaching at Drake, was named Big 12 Coach of the Year. This article was written by Tommy Birch, who is the Register Sports Enterprise and Features reporter and has been working at the newspaper since 2008. He's the 2018, 2020, and 2023 Iowa Sports Writer of the Year. You can reach him at tbirch@desmoinesreg.com or 515-284-8468.
Okay, it's time for Dear Abby. A little late, but here we go.
Dear husband pressures wife to dress more provocatively. Dear Abby, my husband wants me to wear more revealing clothing. I've always enjoyed dressing attractively and have never felt behind the times or like a frump, but I do have my opinions about what is appropriate. For example, if I'm wearing leggings, I wear a long top to cover my bum. My outfits are attractive and not ultra-conservative by any means, but I'm not a crop-top, low-cut, skin-tight kind of gal. I want to be attractive to my husband, but I'm growing really annoyed by his pestering me to wear things in public that make me feel like I'm oversharing. He says he's a guy and he would know if it's inappropriate. I conceded a few times, but it just felt showy and uncomfortable. Your thoughts? Signed, Stingy with the Goods in Maine. Dear Stingy, my thought is do nothing that makes you feel self-conscious. Your husband may be a guy and think he knows what is appropriate attire, but the bottom line is you must be comfortable and not feel embarrassed by what you are showing when you are out in public. Dear Abby, my wife has immersed herself in politics to the extreme. She believes the other side is wrong no matter what. We are in the same political party, but I don't paint as broad a brush as she does on various issues. I try to change the subject if politics arises. I try to keep an open mind until I get all the facts, whereas she listens to nothing that could be positive about the other side. You guessed it. Our discussions always turn into fights and anger with each other. Any suggestions? Tired of talking politics. Dear Tired, in the interest of saving your marriage, because you are talking about politics causes fights and lingering anger, agree to defer listening to news broadcasts together and engaging in those conversations until after the next election. Dear Abby, my daughter is being married. My wife is demanding that I tell her that my stepdaughter, Gia, my wife's only daughter, must take part in the wedding. Gia, who is several years younger, is self-absorbed and has made no effort to be close to her older siblings. My wife has indulged and catered to Gia's every whim since she was a little girl. My daughter wants a short ceremony, and she doesn't want her stepsister to have a role. She has chosen to close her friends. She has chosen her close friends since high school to be her bridesmaid. My wife thinks it's my daughter's duty to include Gia in her wedding. Is my wife right? Signed, Exasperated Husband. Dear husband, no rule of etiquette requires your current wife's self-centered daughter to play a role in your daughter's wedding. If you are arm-twisted into allowing your wife to insert Gia into the wedding as more than a guest, have her stand by the guest register to ensure everyone signs in. That way, she'll be away from the altar and out of the picture. And you can contact Dear Abby at dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California 90069.
Thank you, Pam. That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Patty Daniels, and my partner at the microphone has been Pam Rhodes. Earlier, you heard Dennis May and Barb DeHeck. You can listen to Iowa's programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.